The digital divide continues to be a massive problem made worse by the coronavirus pandemic, but things are especially bad in Appalachia. I'm Roger Chang, and this is your Daily Charge. CNET is once again taking a look at this problem with our series, Crossing the Broadband Divide. And the first story in the latest package takes a look at the unique problems in Appalachia, a region with some of the slowest access speeds and, accordingly, the lowest incomes in the country. With us to talk about this is CNET editor Ray Hodge. Welcome, Ray.
Hey, Roger. How are you?
So, to kick things off, can you give us a sense of how big the broadband gap problem is in this area?
I'd love to do that. If we could actually find that information out in an accurate way. And see, that's the core problem, isn't it? The big core problem here is that we don't have a full and complete rendering of the map of this digital divide. Because for many years now, our mapping has focused on deployment and not speed or actual access. So while we have information about what census tracts have at least one connected household in them, we don't actually know how many houses in each one of these census tracts is connected and accessing broadband, much less whether or not they're getting the speeds that we normally classify as high-speed broadband.
Right. And so we're looking at numbers that are probably severely undercounted. The latest FCC report, which came out last month, said that the number of folks who don't have access to broadband went down to 14.5 million from about 18 million a year ago. Most broadband experts, I think almost all broadband experts, including the federal government and folks on the FCC, all agree universally that that number is probably dramatically low and undercounted. And there's been a lot of issues, as you pointed out, with the data behind these broadband maps that the FCC is in charge of. Some changes are coming, and we'll talk about that later in the series. But let's get back to your story, because you take a look at the Appalachian region specifically. You grew up in Kentucky. You still live near Louisville. I'm just curious what broadband access has been like for you and your family, and how has it changed over the years?
So we were based out of Eastern Kentucky. My family was, and you know, we've moved away from there. So I'm what you would call the diaspora, the Appalachian diaspora. But I didn't get internet in Central Kentucky until the same year we got city water run out to our place, somewhere around 1998, something like that. And even then, you know, of course, it was screechingly slow. Pardon the dial-up pun. But yeah, it's been intermittent, right? So it's taken that long to get it. And where I live now in Louisville, I've got 1 gig fiber. I pay around $60 a month, which is the national average. But there are still people out in the areas where I used to live in where, you know, it may cost them $100 a month to get DSL equivalent speeds. It's insane, the disparity there. But growing up with this sort of slow crawl towards access, it's remarkable to see what progress has been made, because there is some. But it's incredibly frustrating to see that after decades, this is still happening. These problems are still happening. You're still dealing with a basic lack of infrastructure and speeds that are nearly unusable when it comes to stuff like that.
So you talked a bit about the map and the faulty data behind that, but what are some of the other issues that has made broadband access so hard to come by in this region?
So we've got a constant narrative going on where it's always sort of presented as a problem with hilly terrain and we're unable to run lines, or the issue is oftentimes kind of bought and sold by that narrative. And that's only one small part of the equation, right? It's not just about hilly terrain, because we've been able to make all kinds of technological advancements in these areas, all kinds of construction industries like the mining and coal industry have no problem navigating hilly terrain. So, you know, mountains are not necessarily the thing that is always stopping companies from running out there. A lot of the times it has to do with the fact that when it comes to infrastructure, it has to do with the fact that it's not as profitable for companies to run lines out into rural areas, right? Even though they may be picking up subsidies. And there was some fraud that had gone on in different rural regions by companies historically who had claimed to have all these people connected and then didn't. So that's one part of it, the infrastructure politics behind that. The other part of it is that there are two digital divides, right? There's one, which is I don't have the lines, I'm divided from my lines. The other one is I'm divided from the ability to pay for it, which is actually the bigger digital divide across rural and urban areas.
Absolutely. That has been a big problem. And I think you bring up an interesting point, because when it comes to digital divide in terms of access versus cost, you know, the very simple way to paint the picture is, you know, cost is an urban problem, access is a rural problem. But really, you make the point, a very astute point, that actually cost in particular is a problem that spans, you know, across the entire country, across different regions, whether or not you're urban or rural areas, right?
Absolutely. When you've got a national average of $60 a month for basic broadband services, it makes you think that maybe this is the cost of it's being blown out of proportion. But then when you look at the cost to get these lines and get these services out in rural regions like Appalachia, you see how high the average can be out there, particularly when you've got to rely on a mix of services. We've got some folks who are relying on 4G backup from their cell phone data to sort of supplement the cutouts that come with their overly expensive and unreliable home internet service. So you're kind of nickel and diming people in a lot of ways in these mountainous regions. But the fact of the matter remains, 70% of the digital divide among those homes without high-speed broadband access, 70% of them, it's not that they don't have the lines. It's that they can't afford the service. And this is particularly a problem in poverty-hit regions where income is low and federal subsidies like Lifeline aren't able to fully pick up the costs. And within those programs, we're seeing a falling participation rate. Even as other federal contributions sort of eke their way through.
Hey, you mentioned the Lifeline program, and we could talk a little bit about that, but just in terms of that cost issue, like, what are, I guess, local governments doing about this? What's the federal government doing about this? What are some of the solutions to addressing that cost issue?
So there's a couple of things that are really promising and fabulous in terms of municipal broadband, right? So some of these regions, like you'll see in McKee, Kentucky, or in Chattanooga, or even in some parts of Pennsylvania, you'll see municipal broadband efforts where a local area will create their own ISP at some cost. Usually it costs less than a larger one, and they will roll out services that make internet, you know, comparatively faster at more affordable prices. And this is not just a blanket survey. This is something that's been studied at least since I was able to find, since 2009, when the FCC itself commissioned a Harvard study, and they found that not only does customer service, speed, and reliability improve, but the overall market area will see a price drop when municipal competition comes in. So that's one angle of seeing how we can get people a more accessible, more affordable internet service. And the other, of course, is, you know, when we're talking about price caps and regulation there, whether or not we're going to be able to limit some of the pricing as things go on in ways that we haven't seen in the last, you know, 4 to 8 years.
Yeah, I want to talk about that municipal broadband aspect in particular, because you bring up a good point. In your story, you know, you mentioned McKee, which has some of the fastest internet in the country, but really just 90 minutes southeast is another town, Hyden, which has some of the slowest internet access. And so I guess the question is, why aren't more of these municipalities building out their own networks? What is stopping them from doing this?
Well, I mean, the difference between, and anybody from the region will tell you that Hyden is very different than McKee in, you know, in a lot of ways, but when it, you know, but the point being these smaller towns and these smaller communities, right? So building out your own municipal broadband is going to be a major problem, because you've got to essentially, aside from the startup costs for all these things, you've still got to face a big suite of regulatory issues. We saw the battle there play out between ISPs and between local municipal broadband. We've seen those play out in the courts, and we've seen those play out in FCC. So when we looked at like Chattanooga, right? Chattanooga's got a famously good sort of version of municipal broadband, and they had to go to war with you know, political and legal war with, you know, the FCC and with the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Ultimately, it resulted in the FCC's hands being tied if states wanted to outright ban, municipal broadband. But in terms of restricting and regulating and overturning local laws, that the FCC maintained that power. That might be a little bit in the weeds, but what it comes down to is how municipal broadband is changing and evolving and the role that it's playing as we go forward. And right now, the best I was able to find was that about 22 states, six or seven of which in the Appalachian region, are dealing with municipal broadband restrictions, right? Because these patchwork quilt of policies that are either roadblocking development or the ones that are sort of seeking new routes for it are still in process. So you're seeing an emerging patchwork quilt of different policies around municipal broadband. The good side of this, I think, is that it's being considered as a part of the new Biden administration's rollout of his proposed $20 billion reinvestment in rural digital divide efforts, right? So you're looking at not only the Biden administration, but you're also looking at grassroots organizations and coalitions through the region that are saying, hey, it's time to invest in a very diverse and very, very diverse portfolio of connection options, and to start working with private and public partnerships when it comes to getting people connected. Because it's not that no one has a clue how to do it. It's that each one of the region's specific niche areas needs a different sort of combination of services, right? So this varied portfolio is starting to emerge. That can be a great thing. That can be a messy thing. We're still in need of a national broadband plan, as you know, pretty much everyone on any side of the aisle, Republican or Democrat, has acknowledged. We are still in need of a unified national policy on this. But at the same time, we are seeing these things emerge. We're seeing a varied set of voices come out and say, hey, there's a ton of solutions. It's about finding the right one for each of them. And you can look at specific places like Kentucky, right? And so Governor Steve Beshear, his son, Governor Andy Beshear, who is now the governor, Beshear II, his effort to keep students online during the pandemic has required him to shift around COVID-19 emergency relief funds from federal dollars in order to reallocate that towards a lifeline-like subsidy program where, he's trying to make sure that ISPs are able to provide $10 a month services for students so that they can keep on connecting in areas where they don't have service at their house or can't afford it.
Well, that's a good segue, because I want to talk about the Lifeline Fund and how it works. For folks who aren't familiar with the program, talk a little bit about that, and as well as the Universal Service Fund, which is essentially the piggy bank that runs the Lifeline program or funds the Lifeline program.
So the Lifeline program is initially it started out with just making sure that no matter how poor you were, you could get emergency telephone services, right? And then under the Obama administration, I think everyone remembers the controversial, contentious Obama phone program or whatever, right? What that was actually about was expanding that emergency voice service guarantee, where the federal government would pay the ISP to make sure you had voice. It was expanded to include data. And it was also expanded to make sure that you had a handset on your phone, right? Because a lot of times you can only get cell service and internet is not reliable. So expanding that from just voice landlines to data was a huge part of making sure that more people could access this. Lifeline, its fund, it falls under, like you said, the Universal Service Fund. Now the Universal Service Fund is a big umbrella. It's got several programs out there. And one of the programs is the Lifeline program, which pays $10 on your bill. The other part of that Universal Service Fund helps fund infrastructure development into rural areas, public schools, hospitals, prisons, things like that. It helps build the infrastructure that's needed in those areas. Now, this thing has been drawing money from long distance fees that show up on your bill. You'll normally see Universal Service Fee tacked on if you look real close in the fine print. Here's the problem. That fee percentage has kept going up. And it's almost doubled in the last 4 years, right? So it's now at 31.8%, so it's getting higher. The revenue base that it's drawing from is getting smaller. It's shrinking. The money's drying up in there. Now, the money is still out there. The money is still out there for the Universal Service Fund. We've seen millions of dollars and billions of dollars going into different areas trying to get congressional funds trying to get it routed into these digital divide issues. But the formula itself for the Universal Service Fund has been sitting there untended for a while. It first came to the attention that revenues were going to be falling soon in 2001. In 2010, it became even more evident. Right now, the political football that that policy really is sits with something in the FCC called the Universe or the Federal Joint Board, I believe. And it's basically its job is to come up with ideas about, hey, what are we going to do to write a new formula to make sure this funding stays consistent? It's been a big problem. We're not seeing any policy papers. And we've got people on the left and on the right accusing each other of leaving the can to be kicked down the road one administration after the next. But in reality, we don't have a whole lot of reports or papers coming out of that body whose job it is to brainstorm this thing out, to come up with solutions. So we're still sitting here waiting. And yeah, the FCC chairs on from either Democrat or Republican can accuse each other one way or another of neglecting the responsibility of shoring up that fund. But I'm not seeing a whole lot of formula ideas coming out of it.
Yeah, it's obviously a big problem, and you know the solutions are right now their lack of solutions is pretty glaring. It's a problem we're going to be exploring a lot more down the line. Ray, thank you for your time. You can check out our story and the rest of our Broadband Gap series on CNET.com. If you have any questions, hit us up on Twitter at The Daily Charge or sign up for direct text messages from me by heading to CNET.co/Daily Charge. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and rate the podcast. It really helps us out. For The Daily Charge, I'm Roger Chang. Thanks for listening.